Good evening. I'm Glenn Lowry, the director of the Museum of Modern Art, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to tonight's conversation with Gabriel Orozco, which is generously supported by the Junior Associates of the Museum of Modern Art. Gabriel Orozco, born in 1962 in Jalapa, Mexico, has been described as one of the most influential artists of this decade and probably the next one too. He was educated in the Escuela Nacional de Artes Plásticas from 1981 to 1984. He then continued his education in Madrid at the Círculo de Bellas Artes from 1986 to 1987. Orozco is well known for his sculpture, drawing, photography, and video works, which have often resulted from a process of random encounters and contingencies, as well as spontaneous actions and interventions. Recently, Gabriel has extended his investigations to include painting, which continues his research into the phenomenology of structures, using the canvas as a vehicle and abstraction as an instrument of perception and comprehension. Following his first exhibition in 1983, Orozco has had solo exhibitions at the Musée d'Art Moderne de la Ville de Paris in 1985 and 1998, the Serpentine Gallery in London in 2004, and the Museo del Palacio de Bellas Artes in Mexico, most recently in 2006, as well as numerous traveling retrospectives in 1996 and again in 2000. He has participated in our project series here in 1993, the Venice Biennial in 1993, 2003, 2005, the Whitney Biennial, Documenta 10 and 11. He has received numerous awards, including a DAD Artist-in-Residence Grant in Berlin and the German Blue-Orange Prize in 2006. I'm especially pleased, indeed thrilled, that we are organizing a major exhibition of Gabriel's work that will open in December of 2009. In a way, it's a kind of bookend to his project, which was here in the early 90s. Gabriel will present his work for 30 or 40 minutes, and then he and I will begin a conversation, which we will then turn over to all of you to ask as many questions as you wish. So please join me in welcoming a remarkable artist and a friend, Gabriel Orozco.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Glenn. Thank you for that. It's nice. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming tonight. I, of course, wrote some notes, which I'm not going to read, but I'm going to try to follow. I put a lot of images, and I hope there are not too many, but we will try to make sense tonight. Can we? I have to do it, right? Sorry. Well, I start with these images. The Yielding Stone is a plasticine mass of the weight, on my own weight. I start with this piece that I made in 93. To start I would like to start to say what were my concerns at that time in New York, just arriving. I think I wanted to make, or I wanted to think in sculpture in different terms that for me were important issues, and try to put together in one single object all these concerns that I have. One was the static or monolithical aspect of sculpture that I wanted to avoid, somehow trying to work out an object that without any artificial mechanism or any optical illusion about motion or movement could express permanent movement and could have the presence of at the same time something solid and static, but at the same time showing the history of the movement and the history of its creation. So the fact that the plasticine is a material that never hardens is also a material that is is used frequently in sculpture, in traditional sculpture, as a process material, is the material that after is cast in bronze. It makes it very interesting for me. It's a material that is completely vulnerable, completely everything will get imprinted in this material. In even like the fact that it's a greasy substance, make all the dust and everything be trapped in this body. So evidently it's a body, it's my weight, and it's always changing. And the fact that it was done in a public area, in this case in the street, it makes it also a statement that has to do with the body in the urban landscape, the action that happens in reality, and then after, when it can go finally to a museum space, it will still have an ongoing life. It's not a relic after the action in reality. It's also an object that in the life, in the museum, will keep going. It will keep being vulnerable. It will keep being alive in any way, in a sense. And it will be always a kind of present time happening, which was another of my concerns. How to avoid the strategy of the documentation after the action that became a relic and a vitrine, and try to always keep the permanent time of happening in an object. How to turn around the strategies of the 70s in relation with the body in action, in reality, in relation with the happening, in relation with any political gesture, in relation with the urban landscape, but to keep it happening in the white cube space, in the abstraction of the monument of the museum. And the fact that such a banal material as plasticine has these qualities give me this opportunity to try to do this. Now I want to read something. To finish this part, it was important for me also to avoid any anecdotical representation of the body. From the beginning, when I start to do these kind of actions, and I was trying to think about and to express this human scale in relation with the landscape, the urban landscape, etc., was very important for me to avoid any anecdotical aspect. That means to disappear as a person, as an anecdote, to erase my name, to erase my gender, to erase my everything that can be an idea of identity that I consider at that point superficial, and to try to make an object that could be occupied by everyone. In a way, sculpture for me was more a recipient than a statement. And that recipient, always we can think in something that is void. But that doesn't mean that has to be physically void. It can be full like this, but this is also totally void. And is a representation of the body, but without any anecdotical in terms of history or culture that is too evident, and therefore can be occupied by anyone. Evidently, the idea of an action into the quotidian, the everyday, or the objects that are around us was related with this. No? So this is the bread on a piano. And then I start to use photography, as many of you have seen. I always say that a lot of my work is trying to generate an accident or provoke some kind of disorder into the logic of everyday life. So, for example, this is a photo in a workshop of stonework, and this is the way how they cut the stones with a machine. I was trying to do a sculpture in a stone, which failed completely. But the best thing of my experience in this workshop was this photograph, which is the leftover of an action. So sometimes I think photography, in a way, saved my neck. When I have a very bad experience in a workshop of traditional art, at least I can have some documentation of things that I was trying to do with doing real art, but then documenting what happened around, what it is the leftover of the production of a work or what any other object, it can be much more significant than the object itself. This is called Lost Line. It's again the plus symbol is on my weight, but in this case has a thread of cotton from the center to the surface. And when you start to roll that mass, the line, the cotton thread starts to disappear. It starts to be absorbed by the, in a way, it's like an implosion of this line inside the body of the plasticine. This is my bicycle. Throwing stones from roof to roof. A pinch ball after the rain, just found like this. Pour sand on the table, sand on table. I found these oranges in rotten and broken at the end of the day in a market, and I placed one on each of the tables. I found this puddle. I just stand up the piece of wood, trying to make a landscape connected with the landscape in the back. Too many things about. I mean, I can say so many things about this that I don't know how to start. But I can say that, for example, this. I mean, the other thing I have to confront as a sculptor, and I was very interested, is dust. So maybe I should speak about dust. I think when you make a real object, a real meaning a tri-dimensional thing or an action in real life, you always are confronted with the phenomenon of life and that is, for me, is dust. Painting, the worst enemy of painting is dust. But in a sculpture, it's different. Dust is a kind of alley. Dust is this thing that is floating around us all the time. And then the moment there is no movement, starts to appear, starts to be covering everything. We all know that from the illusion of a clean landscape like that in the back to the accident that reveals all the dust that appears, we can have what will be for us. It's an act of consciousness. It's a moment that we probably it's not the illusion of life, but life itself when you have all this. In this case are pieces of laundry that are the dryers in the laundromat. They get in the machine, and after many times they get accumulated, so you have all these threads of the clothes, but also human hair and skin. So I collect them and show them like this in the gallery. It's a very familiar object. After that, I did these imprints. Perhaps it's quite obvious the imprint as a system of evidence of things that happened, that is, in a way, like photography can be, or any human imprint in everyday life. I use photography trying to check those facts also. Like, this is in the outside of Mexico City. I took this photo in 92. It's one of my first photographs. This is later on. It's a cemetery in Timbuktu. It's the way the The tombs are marked with pottery. In 1993, I did the project at here at MoMA, and trying to expand this idea of interventions and acting in the everyday life in the landscape, I asked the neighbors in front to place these oranges in the windows, and at the end, we got most of them covered with these little things, orange, that you could see from the museum. The yielding stone was also around, and then I have the phone book of New York. I cut it and pasted all of it, took out all the names, and just leave the numbers, and I place it on the escalators. It's like 35 meters long. At the same time, in the same project, I installed this hammock in the garden. For me, it was interesting how the garden at MoMA was all these body representations in bronze, or the chairs, these little figures. At the end, I always found it a little bit like science fiction, like a little bit Martians. They're all static. And then you have a lot of people normally also sitting in this chair. So I thought it was good to have a hammock that somebody can use and have yet another representation of the body, but also a useful object. This is also a work that represents a lot of what I try to do in terms of the sculpture being a recipient, being an empty space. The fact that I opened the box and I put the top on the bottom is interesting. For me, it was interesting to also think the connection between the object and the base. What happened between what we consider the art object, the sculpture, and the place we put it, being a table or in the floor or in the classic base. So I think when the moment I put the top on the bottom, it was a very simple gesture, but that implies this kind of opening up and then being its own base, in a way protecting the object from the floor. So this turnaround of things, when you open something, it's like when you take a fruit, an orange, for example, the skin of an orange, and you turn it upside down. I think it's... That gesture of the orange skin is very similar to this one in the elevator. The elevator, the inside of the elevator is the visible thing for us when it's in a building, is the interior that we see. And the outside of the elevator normally is really dirty and dusty because nobody sees it. It's like the part that is hidden. So when I took it out and I cut it up and reassembled, it became this gesture also. So... Again, containers, boxes, even fruits are systems of transportation. And if I was going to talk about movement, displacement, and at the same time perspective and just volume and tridimensionality, I have to talk about and use these instruments of transportation. So as much as the elevator is a very simple way of transporting and cars and shoeboxes and fruits, the idea of cutting up and making more evident the design of a real object, exaggerating the quality of this, was a try to make it more evident in its own dynamic. Evidently, it's a cultural object also. It's not just an abstract gesture. As much as the elevator can be a very precise symbol of a culture and a time in human history, obviously this car can be, but it's the same with a shoebox, I think. When you open up spaces like this and you cut, and then suddenly everyday objects, objects that we know from our everyday life, you open them, then a lot of things can happen, and we have to decide what to do with them. In this case, it's a ping pong table. multiply by 4, and then you generate this space in, that is now tridimensional. When you have a regular pinball table, the net is a non-space, it's a border in which you jump. But when you generate this new space in which there is not a border that is abstract, but you open up that border, and I'm not talking here as an immigrant, but you can take it like that if you want. When you open up a border like that, you then you have to figure out what to do with the new space. You have to do something there. In this case, I decided to make a pond on a ping pong table. It's now for 4 or 8 players. And the balls are dropping the water constantly. There is no more net. There is more like a space that the balls are. The idea of the table, again, as a platform, as a container, as a system of transportation, as a way of protecting our valuable goods, or as a working space, it has been also constant. So what I decided to do is to keep my own leftovers when I am doing experimenting with things or collecting, and I don't know what to do. At the end, I start to pile them. Sometimes in shoeboxes, I pile them. Then at the end, after a few years, I take them out and I show them like this. So a way of having this collection, recollection of objects that people can just, it's like when you arrive in any workshop or a lab or something and you see a table with many things that some of them you don't understand what they are, but you know that somebody is using this and working with those things. So I have some pictures of some details. I mean, you have a good collection of lint, pieces of cars, leaves, old lamps, things that, hotcakes, plastic hotcakes, a sandal. Whale bones, things from the ocean, pieces of the streets, a model for a house, 2 coconuts with the 2 tops of a shoebox. I'm very proud of this one. I can use this also. That's a pizza. And then I make a fractal drawing of in a computer in a clear plastic and I put it on top. So it's like a fractal pizza. But then it got broken, so I have to put it there. Also, the scale is very important. I try to play with the different scales in the work, in my activity in general, from small objects and small gestures to more monumental, big scale actions. I tried not to give any importance. It's just a matter of impact, I think. Impact in my life, and then maybe an impact in other people's life. But in terms of a small gesture, can be as powerful as a big building. So in this installation, I tried to put these tables with the models and things next to the big pieces like the lades and ventilators on top and things like that. So you could go from the table as a board game, a representation of reality to the real objects, all, in, of course, inside a museum, which is a fiction. But then also then try to make a game like a billiard table in oval to play carambol, and then the red ball is hanging from the roof, from the dome of this cathedral. So when you hit the ball, it starts to float and go out of the table. So I think there's also, obviously, it's important, the idea of the container, not to be a kind of vitrine, but it's just an instrument. An instrument in the sense that evidently it's important that any object big question also, and the fact that the ball, for example, in this case, goes out of the table, it's like suddenly becomes part of the real world. When you are playing billiards and everything is inside, it's a game. But it's like suddenly this ball going out is in out in the real world. And also has to do with memory at the end. How memory can be also a wall to understand reality. And when you see a billiard table like this and suddenly the ball starts to go out, you realize that your memory was tricking you. You were expecting the ball just to be inside and rolling inside, and then suddenly it goes out, and it's a way of revealing something very familiar in a way that attacks your memory or the knowledge you have about the object. The same with something like that. It's a game, still is a game. It's just that it's a very different game. And in a way, an infinite game is not two sides, it's more, and it can be permanently in movement. Again, it's a representation of permanent movement, permanent happening, motion. It doesn't have to be played. I mean, interaction in this case, and in general in my work, is not about a physical interaction. It's more about a factual interaction. That means that can happen in the brain of the spectator, but it's happening. In that sense, interactivity for me is more important in a conceptual level or theoretical level than in a physical level. But then I go to make my own games in the city, and this, in this case, I have this yellow motorcycle in Berlin. I have not many friends, and then I decide to go out and to find another, the same motorcycle, the same color. So I did for 3 or 4 months. I collect 40 photographs. There is always my motorcycle with another one that normally was parked. I didn't want to meet people also, so it was just like, in the moment it was empty, I parked next to it and I take a picture, and then I left. If we think in a map of a city, you can imagine waking up in the morning, taking your motorcycle, and then it starts to loose around until you find another one the same. So it was like going out with no objective and playing a board game in a city. That's why I put it next to the horses running endlessly, the chessboard, because I think these are motorcycles running endlessly. And this piece is called "There Is Always One Direction." There are 4 bicycles assembled in on its own logic, in a way. I took out the seat and the maneuver, and I put them together. The idea is that, again, vehicles, transportation systems are made for one direction. There is symmetry there. There is a line of direction. I think I'm trying to lose this line of direction. If we come back to the plasticine ball and the cotton thread that is happening inside and then is losing itself in the body of this piece, if we think in the plasticine ball getting all the imprints, all the accidents, and happening wherever it is, there is not a one direction. It's always many directions. So this is also like 94, completely connected with La Dehesse or the elevator, which I was doing at that time. And I guess it has to do with a kind of collapsing of the reason of being of an object into itself, and then generating a whole new direction which goes nowhere. Perhaps that's why I started to show up with these diagrams and paintings, because I was doing these drawings all the time, but they were in the back, they were in my notebook, so they were kind of things I was doing in my free time when I was doing the other work. So starts from the center, it's always a square. It starts from the center, and the circles are the double or half or the double of the double of the one it's starting. So there is a growing structure that starts from the center and goes all the way to the limits of the square. It's very funny that always board games are square. I think it has to do with rotation too, the way that equal fields for every player. I also think that has to do with the fact that a board game is flat. It happens in a table. And as we all know, in painting is very important how you paint in a table or in a vertical position. Also very important how you relate your body with the thing you are doing. And there are many beautiful texts about all this in connection especially with modern painting. I was trying to think more in a board game and in obviously a very arbitrary and probably stupid game, but a game that was somehow representing, and not in a superficial way, but trying to really understand if it was possible to have a geometric expression of the way I was behaving in reality. Using the same drawing, I divided in four colors, and the colors are placed in the same way as the knight in chess jumps. So one and two or two and one from the center. So if you follow the blue, goes one and two or two and one. There is white, gold, which are the complementary, what I use it as a complementary, the contrary, the total non-color, full or totally empty, gold and white. And then on the other side, red and blue. And those make the balance for me to have this system. Using the same drawing, you convert, the moment you change one color location, you change completely the formation of the diagram, but it's exactly the same drawing. They disappear because the background is blue, then all the blues disappear, which I like also, the idea that there is something is not there visually, but is there conceptually, is there definitely. It's just that it's the same color as the background. I am interested in the gravity point as a sculpture, so I try to use this in the painting, which also sounds ridiculous, but I try. So there is like a gravity point, there is a centrifugal point in the center, and there is the spiral. It's working also as a rotational. Then I did all the variations in, of course, computer printing. There are almost 700. And an animation. But this happened after I did the first drawings. I was not planning to do this serial kind of thing. It's just, I just wanted to see what happened after I did the first one. But then at the same time, I'm trying to deconstruct this geometry in a way that I'm trying to build up this system of geometric speculation. I also try to make trash it down in a way. So this is like in between the circles, this is the background, this is the leftovers of my own investigation, using the same technique. So instead of having the whole structure finalized as a kind of pure geometric statement, I try to shake it up, see what is left, see how the fallen leaves look in the floor, and then from that try to reorganize what sometimes is exactly looks more alive. It's not so much the Platonic geometric structure that we need to understand life, but what it is not geometric, what it is not controlled. So it's an accident into the rule of the game. Like you can have this in a Jaipur town after a kite festival. They have the same title, actually. Just that I did this in 90. It's a photo of 95. It's a kite tree or kite in Jaipur. All these kites after the festival, they got into the stuck into the tree, and the other one is called Kite Tree. The painting before. I'm gonna go a bit faster now. This is the Penske project in New York. I got rent a truck, Penske, and the system of work was with the truck as my studio to make works in the street. Every time I found a container or a trash can or something, I have to make the work in this inside. It's not like I collect trash and then I made it in the gallery, just simply because I didn't have time to do that. The opening was very soon. No, but the game was to try to really solve the problem inside. So when I get into a situation, try to make there a piece or a work or whatever that it was kind of something. And the truck was the way of storing this. So in a way, it was more like a storage, not so much a studio, because the studio was in the street, in the sidewalk. but the truck was the storage, portable storage. So this is what I found, what I did right there with different materials, pieces, a door, open door. It's called open door. It's just that it's open differently. This is the weight of the sun. It's another way of... I put this in here because I wanted to also see that... I also try to work with the exhibition spaces as a reality, not so much as a something outside of real life, but as a reality. So in this case, I work with that, what I found in the exhibition space in the Trinity College in Dublin. And I went to the back room. I got this broom. And I clean up a little bit. And then with the things I clean, I use the broom as a sun, as a kind of planetarium. And I want to just to collect the trash that has the same weight as the broom. And then the broom is hanging from all these cotton things, again, cotton thread, from a center. And then you have all these things that were found in the storage and in the gallery itself. Of course, you will never find this at MoMA, but in everywhere is trash. So pieces of, you know, light bulbs. And at the end, they were all holding the broom in the center. Near the end, these are it's called spumes, using expanding this polyurethane that is expansive. I was pouring this on different containers and latex and everything, and it was just flowing and getting these shapes. In a way, I was really using it as a fluid of, as a leftover of normally it's used for sealing in construction. It's a very weird material, actually. So the shapes, I mean, I was trying to see if this organic way of making it behavior, it's a kind of organic behavior. It's the contrary of a mold. I hate moldings. I hate mold when you have pour a substance and you have already the shape. It's exactly what I don't want in a sculpture. So I was trying to make a kind of base platform in which this substance that you cannot touch because it's very hot, that is very toxic, it can just behave in a very organic way. And then get all this system and structure that was completely organic and unpredictable. And we came out with these things. Well, this is also upside down, so it's even worse. But it looks the same. I think at the end, I mean, this is also an early work, is this idea of the action, the imprint, the body, the organic shaping life, shaping our knowledge, not life in the sense of God, but life in a sense of consciousness about what is happening around us, how we are shaping things. So this is very early clay piece. This is my hand with ice cream spoons. And just to finish this, scold in which I draw a geometric pattern into a very complex organic shape, which is our head. Our head, not just in terms of what we think or how it's shaped, but the fact that we are always, and I try to collapse geometry, system, pattern, bidimensionality, preconceptions, collapse them with reality, with something that is complex, unpredictable, organic, highly complicated. And in that, collapsing of the two realms, I think, is what became my field of work. And that's why probably I use all kinds of techniques, and I will keep doing it, because every substance, every object, every history in every country has all this material that represents what I think I'm trying to explore, and it's very important to for me to have all these levels of research from cultural and historical and political to phenomenological, physical, and chemical. And well, I think it was a good image to finish this. You know, now that I'm dead already. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Gabriel.
Welcome, Glenn. It's a pleasure.
So I want to start a little bit with the idea of the museum in space, because you've just come back from a remarkable project in Mexico City, an exhibition that surveyed your work in tremendous detail. And what was that like to sort of see the arc of your career so sort of early on laid out in such detail in Mexico?
Well, I think I always take it as a also as a game board in a way. Like, it's a way to put a lot of things that are separated around the world and to see them all together, make connections, make new connections. I try to have fun myself. I get very involved in the installation and in the conception of the show. And
were you surprised by the results?
Yes, I mean, I am surprised because every museum is very different, and I take very seriously the specifics of every museum. So I am surprised to see in a classic building like that, the architecture is very grand. It's more like showing in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, you know. So
the where?
In the Metropolitan. I don't know.
I keep getting confused.
It's other place that...
You said something that I thought was interesting.
Are we moving there? No.
you said that museums are fictions, but then you talked about the exhibition space as reality.
Yeah.
What's the tension there? What's the difference between the reality of the exhibition space and the fiction of the museum?
Well, I think you can take that in general in everything we do. I think language is fiction in a way, and art is a language, but it has to do with language. It's communication and structuring some things, but then it's always collapsing with reality. And I think the museum, as an instrument and as an instrument of language, is always having this, also this challenge with reality, with political life, with society, with everything. So an artist, when he shows in a museum, is like showing in a perfect place in theory. You know, white, clean, with air conditioning, and guards. But those are the things that sometimes make trouble to enjoy art. I'm having a problem with this. Is it okay? It's here as well? So the reality of a space like a museum that is in theory, it's a very platonic place. It's like a perfect environment. This out of reality has been a problem for me all the time, and I think for many artists in my generation, how to deal with and how to convert it back into a real place. But I think in general, the collapsing between fiction and reality happens on all levels. So I think, and also you cannot also trust and focus on the museum itself. You have to think about reality in general, many other things, because, you know, institutional critique and a lot of interventions during, you know, the last 40 years that has to do with, let's say, the meta language of art and the institutions. So I have the feeling sometimes they fail to talk about all the things in reality that were as important as the museum itself. So it's all these filters that you have to work out. But it's very important for an installation artist and someone who is working with real objects to deal with the museum like this, like a real space.
You You've often been thought of as part of a generation or one of a generation of artists who are nomadic in their practice. And you spend part of the year in New York and part of the year in Mexico and Paris and elsewhere in the world. Does it matter to you where you practice? Does it change what you do where you're living?
Yes, I think so. Very much. I mean, I'm trying to... I try to get involved in the moment and in the space I'm staying or living or traveling, and it affects completely what I'm doing. Of course, I have my own limitations, and I look at things that normally I look. I mean, I would like to be more open, or as, but then you have your own limitations, and then you start to do similar things. But you can see probably the variety of things I do. They are influenced by the different places I am working. And and that's the idea, in fact. Try to not to have prejudice in relation with what I am living in that moment, but to avoid, or even to try to empty my ego, ego in English, ego in Spanish. Try to empty it so then I can enjoy more what is happening in front of me, you know. I think the artist can be very exploitative with reality in that sense, you know, and impose a style all the time and impose a personality and try, you know. Also, it can be very anecdotal in terms of the experience of the artist as if it was very important or more important than for other people, you know. So I think a way of avoiding all these things that for me are distracting from real encounters with life and reality and fiction, is trying to, yeah, to empty my ego. No?
You've often talked about this idea of the leftover in your work, or the in-between space, the sense of the accident. How do you court accidents? Are they something that just that you're particularly sensitive to? How do you get a sense of this in-between space?
I think it's trying to have a system of work that is always different, but has a system. Like, you generate an idea, like, I'm going to get my Schwalbe motorcycle and I'm going to drive around and see what happens. It's already a way to start the day. You are kind of thinking a system, possible system. But then I am aware, and it's important to be aware of, that is a medium to start to understand things happening around you and to be aware. So it has to do with awareness. And then the accidents will happen. Not that you are going to crash in the motorcycle, which can happen, but the accidents, like, you start to happen things that were not under your control. So in that happen all the time in everything we do, from a painting to motorcycle driving, everything. So be aware of the two, because in that accident, and sometimes the provoking of that accident, the marvelous can happen, and that could be more important than the system. That's why time is very important. So time, sometimes we can spend 2 years in one work. It doesn't mean that it's going to be better than a work that we spend 1 month or a second. So to be aware of time and timing has to do also with being aware of what we can control and we cannot control, and how it happened. Many discoveries have happened like that. It's just an accident in the lab. And then from that accident, you follow up, and then you discover the real thing. And many other systematic, well-planned works, they end up in nothing. A lot of art end up in nothing. And it's very well-planned, you know.
We have storerooms.
Yeah, exactly. Check the accidents.
It seems to me that a lot of this is about entropy, about sort of the pushing of a system until it implodes on itself.
You know, I think it has to do with circulation, because you have a system that has to finish in a circle. I mean, you know, it's like I cut a car, you know, I cut it, but then I reassembled. It's not just the cutting what interests me. It's not just the splitting and showing up the inside of the car. I mean, that is really boring. redynamization of the machine, or the redynamization of the instrument, of the object. So you, yeah, you open it, then you can see what it is, but it was not important. Then you remake it. So you finally in a circle. In between, to do that, you have a lot of accidents. You cut up, you have a lot of blood. And then you have one thing to go, which is quite controlled, and it's a circularity and keeps going. But then you have all the other possibilities. So it's not linear, you know? It's more like it's always different orbits and different ways of circulation. And that's why it's permanent motion. It doesn't end up in trash. There is no trash in a sense. It doesn't exist. Recycling and going.
There's a dimension to so much of your work that is about gamemanship, about creating a game for yourself, following it, in a sense. Do your games have rules? And as participants in your games, when we pick up a ping pong paddle and try to play ping pong on the table, are we meant to invent our own rules? Are we meant to discover that there are no rules? How playful do you want these works to be? Do you expect these works to be?
Well, I think you can say that it's the same in every work of art. You know, there is some there is something the artist wants to say, and there is some system to generate this sign and to say, I want to say A, B, and C. And I think you have to really try to express that. For that, you need rules. In any work of art, there are rules. They're like in any language. And then, of course, the spectator and culture and life and history invents other rules, you know. So, yeah, I mean, for horses running endlessly or for a ping pong table like that, you need to know how to play ping pong and how to play chess a little bit so you understand what is the difference. Then you can obviously think in the logic of the new game, the logic of the new card, and the logic of the new painting. But for that, you need some knowledge of the rules. And then you can invent your own rules because it's going to happen anyway. But the paintings, they have a rule. They have a role of understanding that painting, which it doesn't mean there is an imposition. I mean, it's just that it has a rule of a logic. Thanks to that logic, you end up in a shape like that, in a design like that, in a conformation like this, because there are rules. And then after that, it starts to behave like, you know, like a tree in nature or something. It's like we see all the trees the same, but they are not all the same. They're all very different. They have all different ways of behaving, et cetera. So it has to do with knowledge. In that sense, the rules is how they work. To play a game, and to play a game in art, and to understand art, you need to know some rules. And then you start to misbehave. But then there are rules to be known, I think, in general. A system, diagram. It's not rules in terms of order, but it's a system of knowledge.
There's obviously within that context, there's such a Duchampian thread through a lot of this playfulness with systems, the use of ready-mades or found objects. Is Duchamp an artist that you think about? Is he an artist that you are reacting to or responding to, or is he just some guy in the past that?
A guy in the past. Well, I can say that now. Yeah, a guy in the past, but 7 years ago was not in the past for me. I mean, he can never be in the past for the. I mean, at least now, I think it's very important. All the the discoveries and jokes and systems that he creates, you know, and they are very useful, consciously or unconsciously, by most of the artists today, I will say. So I think he's a very important artist in general. So maybe I'm thinking more in other artists now, but Duchamp is definitely an artist that has influenced most of the art that we have seen today, you know? So we are seeing that, and I think probably because he invented some ideas and some systems of work that are very useful today, you know. I think art is an instrument, and the way an artist is also remembered is because his discoveries are useful. for younger artists and a way of work, you know. It's not about taste or anything. It's about usefulness, I think, in that sense.
I was struck, actually, when you were showing the tables, that, and I hadn't thought about this before with your work, that there's also a connection to voice, not only in the performative side, but in the idea that all of these random pieces, some of them deeply meaningful to you, others just the result of an accident or something you picked up, get reassembled into a space, a fictive space of your making and control that then becomes autobiographical.
Well, I would say that I don't think it's that autobiographical, you know. I think, yeah, I mean, I never thought about it in relation with voice. I can see the connection, but I try to avoid the vitrine and the relic some a little bit, you know. Mm-hmm. My wish is that they understand the tables more as a working evidence, as a leftover a little bit, but in a sense that are not fetishes, you know. They are not like the meaning has a spirituality or anything like that. I think it's more like more banal, you know. So I try to, of course, I understand that there is a museum there and, you know, it's very clean, everything, and you have always this problem. We have that problem. But the meaning and the intention is not that close to voice in that sense, I think. And I try to avoid anecdotal things. I try to disappear in all my actions, you know. I try to more like to generate an empty space. And, you know, I try to show like the wave when the boat is moving, the wave behind, you know, the space that is there is a turbulence and there is this empty space, but that can anyone can use it. It's not about me.
But the tables are very carefully composed.
That I have that problem, yeah. That is not good. But then I trudge them like that and I'm very nervous all night, and then I go back to the museum and I rearrange them. I think I need clarity. If I put them just like that, it's going to look like Jason Rhodes or something now. It's going to look different, you know. And it's too intentional for me to do that. To be trashy is too self-conscious. I think I prefer to be neutral. Neutral in the idea of the grid. I try to make a kind of grid in which you expose all the objects in some kind of neutrality so people can walk around and see them and not to see just the trash I made, you know. I leave that. Rickert can do that very well, but I try to put it in order so you can see it better.
Let me turn this over to all of you now for any questions, comments. If you have some, don't be bashful. Yes.
You said you were thinking of other artists today more than Duchamp. Could you tell us some of those artists?
Yeah, sure. I just think now lately a lot in Max Ernst, in the collages and things. I always think in Schwitters even more than Duchamp, Kurt Schwitters. Marcel Brothers, always. André Cadere, always. John Cage, also. I'm reading Carolyn Brown's book about Merce Cunningham and John Cage, which is very nice. Something like that, yeah.
Yes.
Which artist I liked when I was younger? Yeah. Like Salvador Dalí. Like everyone else. Well, then we grow up. That's good. Huh? I don't remember, really. I mean, Smithson, student. I was reading Smithson a lot. Gordon Matta Clark. Yeah, these kind of guys, you know, when I was a student. And before that, Salvador Dalí. Yeah.
Yes.
I have a cleaning lady, yes, I do.
She's not allowed to touch the dust, though.
Exactly, that's a good point. Yeah, I have a, it's a good story, actually. It's a woman that worked since long time, and she laughed a lot in Mexico, and she was, in Mexico City, yes. She was part of the family more than a cleaning lady, just that she just retired last December. But she was very funny to play around with. I mean, she knew what not to touch, and it was not easy to understand. So it was very funny, very dusty.
While we're on domestic issues, you recently built a house.
Yes.
Did you treat the house with the same sort of sense of gamesmanship, of thinking of it in terms of a system?
And yeah, completely.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, first, it's a house is based in an instrument. It's based in the observatory of Jantar Mantar in India, which was built in the 17th century, well, before in 1970-something. By a Maharaja who wanted to build the best observatory in the world. And he built up this complex, this architectural complex. You could see the stars, and at that time there was not a telescope or anything, so it was more like architectural things, so you could watch the sky. I saw that, and I liked very much this thing, and I thought about this, to live in an instrument. What will happen if you live, when a house is an instrument, but then we distorted somehow, and then the house became something else, right? So it's like living in a car. A car is more like an instrument. Of course, you don't want to live in a car. But then I was thinking, living in an observatory. You know? So then I translate this into a house. I convert this thing into a possible house, and I thought it was a good idea. So it's very funny because as much as I can take Lades, a car, or an elevator, or a bicycle, and remake it, I took this also, a very specific cultural object, and I converted it into something, I would say, useful for me at least. So yes, it's an instrument, and then yeah, it works. I mean, it's really an observatory. And then also, I think it's very playful, the way you circulate, the ups and downs, the inside and outside. There is a swimming pool in the center, but then in the roof, so you, when you are down, you don't see the swimming pool, so to go to the, you go, and it's very small, it's not big. It's half a sphere. So it has all the elements of my work, I mean, in my interest there. So I really try to use it as really much as very much as an instrument. It's not so much a house in the traditional sense, you know.
But this interest in architecture, it has a thread in your work. You, when you were in Venice, I think it was 4 years ago now, or almost 4 years ago now, you took over the garden, recreated that wonderful arcade that Scarpa had done. Is architecture a development now? Is that a new area of investigation? Is this the beginning of a series of actions on your part?
It could be. I think it has been always there. As much as I was dealing with the real spaces, you have to understand architecture. Also, I have to say I worked with an architectural firm when I was a student. And not as a drawer, but more like kind of designing things. And that gave me some training as an architect for 2 or 3 years. And I like architecture very much. I think it is. I will not take it very seriously, because I don't like architecture also. I don't know how to explain this. I don't trust in these architectural things very much. I think architecture is a big problem too. But the same with video art and film. I don't trust it so much. So, that probably is for another occasion we can talk about it. But there is something that the idea of being an architect or exploring architecture and taking that very seriously, I find it very problematic. I don't think it's that interesting. And I think we have seen a lot of bad architecture lately because it is happening like this, you know? So So I think we have to be careful with that. But anyway.
Another question. Yes.
There is this whole tendency in Latin American art coming from constructivism, especially in geometric abstraction, as we see upstairs in this exhibition. It's more related to Venezuela, Brazil, Argentina, not so much to Mexico. So I was wondering if there is any model in Latin American art that kind of inform your work.
We have a geometrical movement. It's just that it's a bit later than the Venezuelan or Brazilian. But we do have the Ruptura generation. They were very geometric. And they were, 60s, 70s. I don't think I took nothing from that generation personally. Now I could see some things of Elio Tisica or Ligia Clark that I love, but it's late. I mean, it's not that were important in my formation. Now I appreciate that. But they were not very well known in Mexico, as much as they were not very well known anywhere, really. But it's true that there is a strong geometric tradition in Latin America, but I would probably say that it's in all Europe in general. I mean, I think it was quite something happening all around the world, that geometric interest. I would connect it more with early modernism, with an ideal that many people in the world share of, a kind of idealism of geometry, urbanization, it has to do with modernism, with Le Corbusier, with abstraction, with Rodchenko, with constructivism, with everything was all around that, So I will not say it's just Latin America. And I like that. There is something that I found quite interesting of this, I will say, infantile geometrization of the world as a kind of better place. I like that idealism. Of course, we have destroyed everything like that, but I mean, it has a lot of problems, but there is something that I found interesting, and it's not just in relation with Latin America, I think, so.
Yes?
I want to reflect a little bit on your sense of awareness, like paying. I guess it's like the philosophy of Alan Capra that you're always paying attention and you turn your paying attention into art. And so I was just wondering, as you were growing up making work, or not making work, but the transition between living life and thinking that this could be art, turning the things that you were aware of and that you noticed into an art context, and how you declared yourself an artist, like at that turning point, maybe, if you could reflect on that.
I think it was kind of all the way around, because I grew up in the art world. My father was a painter, my mother was a pianist, and I grew up surrounded by many artists. And so I saw that all my childhood, the way of being of an artist. But the classic artist, like studio painting, he was helping Siqueiros in murals, doing some mural. I helped them to do, as a kid, to make some money to buy a car. So there is something about the way the everyday life of an artist that I grew up with. And for me, what started to be challenging, I think, was when somehow I got bored of the traditional way of being an artist, which means like the classic studio, the classic techniques and all that. And then I started to try to find out for myself how I could do it, what type of work, practice, discipline, life will be to make what I wanted to do. But then I was not, for me, it was not so important to define that is art or not. It was more like thinking, what are the reasons for art to exist? Or why art exists? Then you ask that, and then you kind of find out things that can be or not art, but then it's not important. So it's not, it's very intuitive, but then you have to make it, and then you have to also build up a way of living that, and behavior in life, in the street, in everyday life, so you can make the type of work you think you would like to do. So,
you once said, I think in a documentary, that you had to stop making art before you really found what you could make. Is that what you meant by this?
Yes, in a way. I think I have to stop. I think I have to stop thinking as an artist, as a kind of classic artist. At some point, I have to stop thinking all the things I learned in the academy, because I have an art school academy, I have my family and all that, and I really have to start to stop thinking like that. And for example, my father didn't understand at all what I was doing. He was like, really, really, it was a serious distance, because he couldn't get it at all. And I was not sure I wanted to even discuss it. So I was just like trying to do things. And then, but in that sense, for example, photography was important, because we have this, in the 80s, especially in Mexico, we have a strong photojournalism generation, where photography is very much into the school of Manuel Álvarez Bravo, which is, you know, classic black and white photography, photo reportage and all that. And I grew up close to these people too. So I was against many things. I didn't like the way the photographer was also exploiting reality and exploiting the drama of everyday life. I didn't like that. But on the other hand, I like the instrument, how it could be great to archive all the investigations you could do with that, you know? And so I would say that in my change from painting and traditional whatever drawing, photography was very useful in that sense. But also being against photography too. I mean, against classic photography in the way it's connected or exploits the drama of the everyday life, you know? I don't like that spectacularization also. But photography was very important in that, very good instrument. So,
Do you consider your first photographs your earliest works?
Could be, although I did a lot of work that I never took photo because I didn't have a camera. And you don't remember this, but in 86, 87, it was very expensive to buy a film. And it was different then. So I did a lot of things at least for 3 to 4 years, from 85 to 89, in which I didn't take any picture. I was just playing around, and sometimes I took a piece of wood and I leave it there. I have my notebooks, but they were not descriptive. I was more like thinking in other things, more philosophical and then action, but I was not interested in the documentation of this. And then at the end of the 80s, they came out the small cameras, the autofocus Sony, whatever, that is very portable and affordable too. And then I also could take it with me into trashy places without having a Nikon like this, that was a very risky thing to do in Mexico. So I have my little camera, and then I start to take these snapshots, and they became my first photographs. Before that, I remember sometimes with friends, they have a camera. They took some pictures, and some of them I keep. But for a few years, I didn't do photography like that. So I think first was to work with real objects, like trash, real tri-dimensional things, whatever, and then photography became very useful, even though I was not thinking to show photography. I was just thinking to archive these things and then have them to think about. I loved slides. I never used negatives. I also didn't like the dark room, the classic photography. I hate the idea to go into a dark room and develop photography. I was more into the color also. I was interested in color and the idea of slides and the archival. And that's why it was useful photography.
Other question? Yes, in the back.
Yes.
I'm curious about your response to New York City and how that has affected your work in contrast to San Francisco.
Well, I always liked New York since I was very young. My first time here was to see the Picasso retrospective in this museum in 1978. 78, I was 78 was the first one, I think. One of the first ones. 78. So I was, I'm 62. Well, I don't know, 14 years old or 15 years old, and I came with a friend just to see that exhibition. And in the 70s, New York was dangerous. So I came to see that, and I came back. Every 2 years, I was coming here. I like New York always, and I always came to see shows, and I like to see architecture also. So I was very, so in the moment I just decided to came here, it was very easy to get integrated. I already have friends, somehow it was like that. And I feel very free to work, to do my own work. At the same time in Mexico, my work was, I don't think people really understood very well and was not like, I don't know, people was asking me to keep doing my old work and I didn't want to do that. So I also was working with some friends in Mexico doing things, but then at some point I also was tired of having kind of, I don't know, I have a kind of workshop with some students and they are doing great now, it's very nice, but then I just decided to be here, to be alone, to be free to do my work. And the life in the city helped me a lot to do things. And most of my best work, when I moved here, it was done here in New York. Because I was also going to Europe, I have to say. It was not just New York. I also started to travel immediately. I think one of the characteristics of my generation in New York is that we start to travel a lot. It was not like in the 80s that many of the artists in the city, they were just in New York, showing in New York, and all the time here, partying here, living here, everything here. We really start to travel a lot. And some people in New York, telling us, why you are never here? You are doing really well. We like you. You have all these shows, but you are never here. You know, Trickrit and all my generation, we were all over in Korea, in you name it, first like 10 years of. So that combination between having this environment in New York and being in the world was a great combination, I think. It's a moment that also the whole country, I think, this country, really tried to start to be more open in many ways in terms of different types of art and culture. So I think...
Is that degree of travel still important to you?
In a way, yes, but it's different. I mean, I think before it was a combination between exploring new art world scenes and new experiments and working and traveling with friends and artist friends. It was a kind of common experiment. And we did great things, I think. We also did great friendships. It's a generation that has good contact with each other without being labeled as this or that movement. I think every very different artist, but we are good friends. And now I think, I don't know, it's different, I think. It's not the same spirit of traveling. But I do specific trips. Like last year, I did a two-week trip to the Amazon in two quite remote places. But it was the team was one ethnobotanist, two photographers, one filmmaker, and one political ecologist. And I was like doing whatever I could. We traveled for 2 weeks, but it was an interdisciplinary trip. And then after that, we got to recollect the documentation and different things. So I think I like now the idea of very specific traveling with more like an exploration kind of thing. And, you know, it's not so much like wandering around in the art world in general, you know. I think it's different.
Yes, in the back.
One other influence, maybe. You have a very young son now, and I wonder if that's changed your art at all.
I should just identify for everyone the voice of Ann Temkin, who is curating the exhibition of Gabrielle's that will be here in December of 2009, and also a parent of a young child.
Exactly, and living very close to, in the same area, in New York. I don't know actually. It's a boy. We play a lot together. I like to play. I am playing more video games now than before.
You may change your idea about media very quickly.
Yeah, maybe. I hope not. But so I think it's I feel the same actually. In general, I think I feel the same. But it's, you know, it's something I was looking forward to have, and it's great. And so yes, there is one thing that traveling is gonna. But no, I mean, he has traveled a lot. He's 3 years old. We were already 2 months in India, then in Paris. Then I mean, he is already quite used to airplanes, for example. I think he's going to be a different boy than me. I mean, perhaps also the way I am trying to, as much as I try to work differently as an artist, the fact that I don't have a studio, for example. I tried not to have a studio for, when I came to New York, one of the decisions I took was not to have a studio. Because to have a studio, then I need to work as a waiter to pay the rent for the studio. So I decided better not to work as a, not, anyway, not a studio, too much rent. I work in any table, in any corner, in any coffee shop, whatever. And still try to keep that. Although I have some help that people is doing in places, but I don't think I have my own studio. I found situations, I made communities of work, I made always collective, I will say, or communities. So I think he is getting integrated into this life. And I don't feel that I have changed so much. I think he's more like a new member in a team, you know? So
little does he know.
Little does he know.
Other questions? Let me ask a couple more, Gabrielle, as we bring this conversation to a close. It seems to me that there's an aspect of your work that's almost like a cultural anthropologist, a kind of investigation into the way not only you respond to a variety of phenomena, the city being, you know, a large playground and a source of discovery, but also the way we learn about ourselves by seeing oranges in the wrong location or a car that's impossible. I'm a cyclist, or the stress of a bicycle that makes no sense, or at least doesn't make sense in the kind of logical and rational way in which we've come to understand an idea or a form or a shape. Are you form making, or is there a sense of trying to take apart what we think we know in your work?
Yeah, well, I think it's not to take apart what we think we know. It's more like reconfigurate or re-dynamize or recycle or re. It's just to give a new possible identity to every object or to everything. It's also a way of for me to explore them first, right? So I want to do this by personal reasons. Then, of course, being conscious that this will be also a way of communication of some things. So it's not by chance that I choose Lade's very specific car. It's not by chance that I choose an elevator in Chicago. And the bicycles are from Amsterdam. There are many things that are very specific in terms of, you know, the object and all that. And evidently, I'm not interested in just the abstract, in just the cutting or just the gesture like that. I am not an abstract artist at all. But on the other hand, I am very interested in geometry and in the diagrams and in all that. So when you are not abstract, then you what you are? You are obviously into content, into politics maybe, into history, into, I will not say anecdotical, but you are also aware that exists the anecdotical, that is, you know, there is history in everything we do. So every material we are, in fact, every material we use, it has a cultural meaning. A canvas, marble, a stone, all has, everything has a cultural meaning. Everything is charged with history. So the fact that I use a car, a very specific car, or I use the fruit as an orange that, you know, or the fact that I place these sticks in front of the World Trade Center is because I am aware of that history there and the, what it is happening there. Precisely because it's not one of the things, if you think about me in terms of a Mexican artist, for example, like growing up in Mexico and then being here, is that the solution of not being considered a Mexican artist is not being an abstract artist. You know, it's not about being non-Mexican. That is also a mistake that was very much from the past, the relationship of, you know, the complications of politics in art, you know. But now, the fact that in every country I work, on every relationship I establish with everything is being aware of the culture of that thing. Was a way of rediscovering, recycling, redynamizing identities, not just for me as an artist, for the object, for the spectator who was going to see that. So that photography of the World Trade Center and that, I mean, I can imagine that many people here can see it as symbolic and quite something you can identify as a New Yorker. But it's also by accident like that also happened. You cannot pretend to make a symbol in every work you do, because then you are trying to convince people that you are right and that you can have the power to generate something symbolic and then to represent these people. And that is very pretentious. So I think that is more an exploration that has to do with identity, but not the identity of the anecdotal or not the identity of the imposition, not the identity of the martyr, not the identity of the victim, not the identity of an international. I am not international. You know what I mean? I'm national. I'm Mexican. I live here and there. And I do this. I do work with real objects from different cultures with all that. I sometimes have generated some symbols because people feel identified by this and maybe they are, you know, they feel their identity in those things. But this by accident. It's not by accident, but it's by chance, by coincidence. But it's not that I'm trying to generate a message of being good or being this or that, you know. So
let me come. Yes.
How do you react to the way people react to you? How do you react to the way people react to your work?
Depends how they react and how I react to my work.
Do you try to incorporate it? Do you try to ignore it? Do you use it in some way?
Well, my favorite is when they look at their own lives and reality and things happening in a different way. That I feel that then is useful. But I don't listen too much to what people like, I don't know how to explain it. I mean, I feel a bit embarrassed sometimes or something. But then when I feel that it's useful for other people to see different things in life or to laugh and to play differently, I react. I mean, I it's when I like the best. I mean, that reaction is my favorite, so. I feel there is something that I feel quite positive about the reaction about that my way of acting in reality and all that. I feel the complicity of many people, and that feels very good because it's not about my success. It's not about celebrity kind of thing, all that. That is actually horrible. I really don't like that at all. It's more about that they feel identified, or you know, so other people that from different nationalities, different age, very surprisingly, from all kinds of people, they feel. I feel their complicity. I feel they are on my side. They want to see more. They want to be with me. They want to keep going somehow, and that feels good. Very good.
Yes, the last question
in the middle.
The role of social commitment, if any, in your work?
Well, nobody knows that, no? Social commitment is hard to, that's a hard word. I think in my case, and as I have said, and I try to do it, has to do with being an individual with no prejudice, with resolution in terms of the life I'm living, in terms of the way of changing my own life, my way of growing and all that. So it has to do with keep my own independence and individuality. Try not to feel the pressure of being good or do good or tell the others what they have to do. No, don't waste too much time in denouncing, because I think it's, you can make a career in denouncing, and I don't think that is something we need. I think it's more about building up, about generating a universe. It sounds pretentious, but please understand the word universe as a way of making your own platform for communication with other people. I grew up also in a very political family, and obviously from the left. And then I grew up with the discussion about political art all my childhood. And I was very political activist in a way as a teenager. I like it. It's great, and you have to be very political. But then I end up appreciating as an artist more that resolution of being free to really change all the time my techniques, do this, that, in my own exploration, and being aware that it's always a communication there. It's not just selfish. It's not just my own experience, my own thing, but the consciousness that everything I do somehow is language and somehow has to do with communication to other people. I don't know. That's why I have created some communities of work, I think. And I feel responsible for that. And I also feel responsible for the influence of my work in other artists, in younger artists. And I am very much aware of that, and I'm glad that it's useful for them. So that's what I feel is my social commitment. Maybe it's a bit too general of an answer, but the role of an artist today, and after the different role models we have seen in the 20th century, from Warhol to Beuys, to Richard Serra in general, you have different social type of artists behaving in society in a different way. And I don't have a particular role model from an artist of the past that I like, I have to say. So I think I have to generate my own way of behavior and activity in social life. So when I'm saying independence or being individual or something, it is not being isolated at all. I think I am, the contrary maybe, trying always to build up things with other people. But for example, I don't like to use cheap labor in my work. I don't like to use or to pay things that reproduce a system of exploitation in general. I try to be ecological as much as possible. I think try not to make the idea of denouncing or social critique or something a way of living, but more to act and to build and to construct than to make a career out of making, a spectacularization of politics. Try to avoid that. I don't know. Should I keep going?
I think the result of what you do in closing
I really want to underscore this, is a generosity, a generosity of spirit to share with us this evening, really the sort of inner thinking of how you not only approach art, but approach the experience of life. And the result of that generosity, I think, is a body of work that is not only consistently inventive and consistently provocative, but is a body of work that at its very core always makes us think. And in thinking brings stimulation, engagement, enjoyment, and a sense of wonder. And I have been really impressed by the degree to which your objects are always invested not only with all sorts of formal qualities, but deep meanings, and yet they're open to multiple interpretations. And in doing so, I think you share with us the essence of what it is to be alive. And for that, we thank you a great deal.
Thank you very much.